It's the Nuclear Iran edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, our Prairie correspondent shares thoughts about the Duffy trial, the Iran nuclear deal, what you need to know, the future of food, the science of overpopulation, and peak name. Will we run out of names? Let's begin episode 292.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is going to be delivered by the Prairie correspondent, who's going to give us their take on the Duffy trials and tribulations. Let's listen in.
There's a trial taking place in Ottawa involving Senator Mike Duffy. Duffy's previous occupation was as a journalist, newsman, and television personality, well-known and well-liked. At least, I had nothing against him. He became a senator when appointed by Stephen Harper. In that post, he was held in high regard by the PM, it seems, not so much for his senatorial abilities, but his artful endeavors as a fundraiser for the Conservative Party. So my question is, are any Canadians paying attention to suspended Senator Duffy's trial? I must admit, I was a bit of a political neophyte years back, but I have to say, since the Harper Conservatives robocalled their way to majority, I've taken an extraordinary interest in what goes on in the Capitol. I started out by asking, how many of us are paying attention to Duffy trial, and what's being unearthed in the courtroom? I'd hazard a guess that more than a few are not even aware there is a trial. And some, well, consider it boring, and there's better ways to spend their time, and then there's those most disconcerting of all that think it's old news, history, let's move on. To a point, they're right. Tick-tock. The clock is ticking. This is our democracy we're talking about here. And we're so complacent, we can't scrape up enough interest to fight for it. Right now, the defense attorney Bain is establishing the rules, or lack of, that will allow someone like Mike Duffy to abuse the institution of the Senate chamber, and by doing so, Canadian citizens. The rules are apparently guidelines, perhaps crafted by the House's sober second thought, with the belief that anyone appointed a senator, anyone willing to accept the position, would be worthy of the trust placed in them. In other words, just because you can, doesn't mean you should. Oh my God, who doesn't know where they live, primarily speaking? Tough question for some of the senators, apparently. It's a residence in a province in Canada in which there's a dwelling where you live most of the time, where you obtain your health card, driver's license, and it's listed on your income tax form. Harper's reply to the fact that there might be objections to Newfoundland being Duffy's primary residence was, they'll get over it. Money-raising abilities was the compelling motive. Mr. Duffy filled in both spaces of his application form to the Senate. I'll give him credit. If anyone actually read the application, they might not be in the hot water they're in today. The revisions were made in his handwriting and initialed, so you could say he wasn't trying to mislead anyone. It only goes to show there's more wrong with the Senate than one senator. Just the tip of the iceberg, it seems. The idea that a senator is an intelligent, well-educated, trustworthy individual kind of takes a beating here. That a senator would know the rules, used loosely here, remember, they're only guidelines, and being of such moral stature, seeing the open-ended reimbursement logistics, would not be tempted. Okay, even if tempted, would not screw around with the public purse. It's about more than where a senator lives. It's the misuse and abuse of taxpayers' money. I suppose that's the fallout when senators are appointed solely for their fundraising talents. Along with the Conservatives, the Liberals and Independents make up the Senate. 88 seats to date. Fill in the 17 vacant seats, and it's a full house at 105. Funny thing I came across as I was refreshing my memory. Pretty sure you'll laugh, too. Duffy and Wallen are listed as independents. How's that for stretching the old believability elastic band? top most successful fundraisers for the Harper Conservatives, and they're listed as independents. Remember, these are the same folks who don't know where they live most of the time. Well, okay, in all honesty, I have to admit, prior to the Senate scandal and their fall from grace, they were listed as conservative along with Brazil. The three of them were appointed by Harper. Add to this the fact that every prime minister today has stacked the Senate with their own loyal followers as payback for devotion displayed. How can this be considered the House's sober second thought when members are beholden to a leader of the country who's also the leader of a political party? As someone once said, you dance with the one that brung you. Has to be a better way. No doubt there are honest senators, and that's a sad state of affairs for them, given the consensus that they're all a bunch of crooks and opportunists just waiting to line their pockets. One would have thought there would have been an uprising from within, but no, they seem to have circled the wagons and stand united in their denial. The information gleaned to this point for me is to lay out for all to see the potential for the misuse of privilege on so many fronts. Will Duffy be found guilty of the charges against him? Will it bring about a change? Will the Senate be a more accountable institution because of it? We'll just have to wait it out. It's early days, and there's much more to be laid bare to anyone interested enough to care. The blame, as I see it, lies at Harper's doorstep. This is the all fallout from Harper's style of government. He was the guy who trumpeted transparency, accountability in government, espoused dissolution of the Senate, then once given the opportunity to make any of these changes, concentrated instead on the unraveling of our democracy. He praises the armed forces and jumps in with both feet in any conflict he can find, and then hobbles the vets when they return. He harangues the provinces with their flailing environmental efforts, and he and his government laugh at global warming and do little, or worse, hinder. Conducts press releases with embedded journalists in front of friendly audiences, kowtows to corporations over citizens. Major news announcements are always issued abroad to foreigners. The blow-up in the Senate, the Duffy and Wallen appointments, selling off Canadian assets to foreign interests with no consultation, tying the hands of future governments with this huge deficit the cons have cultivated with their mindless advertising campaign and misuse of government funds with never-ending court challenges. By the time Harper and his cons lose the 2015 election, will there be anything left of this beautiful country, Canada? So I say to you with my most heartfelt request, please care. Our democracy has never been in such peril from within. We, the citizens of Canada, are the only ones that can protect our country, our way of life, from the abuses of power demonstrated against us since the Harper government obtained their questionable majority. We have to take our country back. We have to hold those in power accountable. 2015, never forget.
I suspect there will be more revolutions to come out of the Duffy trial, and as the old saying goes, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And I am so glad that this is an election year. Who knows what crop we may raise. So we're going to be back after this break.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Okay, you may have heard that Israel will cease to exist as a nation in a few months. Well, that's according to the Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu. Why did he make such a proclamation? Well, according to him, if Iran gets the bomb, the first thing it will do is nuke Israel out of existence. This is what has been termed by the radical right as Israel's existential risk. Now, of course, Bibi has been making this claim that Iran is only months away from a nuclear bomb for decades now. In fact, he was saying the same thing about Iraq in the 90s, a claim that was proven very wrong by the Iraq War, too. That being said, it is true that Iran is pursuing nuclear technology. It claims for strictly civilian use. Sadly for Iran, even if it were true, there is good reason, given previous track records, to be distrustful of them. Thanks to the experience with India and Pakistan, faith that a nation will only use the technology for nuclear energy has been proven wrong, as both of those countries took nuclear energy programs and turned them into nuclear weapons programs. When you couple this fact that attempts to contain the bomb in North Korea failed, and thanks to Republican propaganda, many think Iraq was flouting UN inspections vis-a-vis nuclear weapons, that being one of the primary reasons for their invasion. Anyway, all of that has led the world, in general, to cast a very wary and suspicious eye towards Iran, even if some people, re Bibi and Israel, are overplaying the immediate or actual risks. On that note, you may have noticed the news flooded with stories about the Iran Framework Agreement. What is the Iran Framework Agreement? It's an agreement, well, near agreement, on a framework that will eventually lead to a deal that will, somewhere down the road, lead to the containment of Iran's possible military nuclear ambitions while allowing for the fruition of its civilian ambitions. And mostly from Iran's perspective, the listing of global sanctions. To help my loyal listeners to Radio Free Thinker get a grasp on what's going on, I thought I would provide a primer on the situation. So to start, we should understand Iran's history and its position in the Middle East. Iran is one of those nations that has had many lives. There's often a tension, I'm not sure if that's quite the right word, as to whether the people living there are Iranian, Persians, Arab. That said, if you ask any of them, they'll say Iranians, but the other labels come up because of the long history of the region, the history that has included massive empires and crushing defeats and conquests. The modern history of Iran begins with the Pahlavi dynasty, which took control of Iran in 1925. During World War II, the Allied forces sent the Shah, the Iranian equivalent to King, into exile and ruled the country as a triumvirate between the Soviet Union, Britain, and the USA. Not quite as simple as that, but that's the basic layout. Although Britain controlled most of the Iranian oil reserves prior to the war, the occupation cemented this control, which was eventually shared with the USA. At the end of the war, the Soviets refused to leave northern Iran and set up sort of buffer states, a policy a war-ravaged USSR did pretty much on all its fronts. They were eventually forced to leave by 1946, but the tension this event created was one of the foundations of the Cold War. In 1941, what would be the last Shah of Iran took the throne. In spite of the occupation and the policy of foreign economic domination, Iran exited the war with a relatively strong democratic government, with the Shah as sort of the nominal head of state. However, this democracy proved to be an uncomfortable fit when in 1951, Mossadegh was elected Prime Minister of Iran. One of the planks he and his party ran on was the nationalization of Iran's vast oil reserve. Iran was getting about 15% of the profits from the oil, with the rest reaped by the British and the Americans. Mossadegh was forced to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company when it refused to offer the 50-50 profit sharing its Saudi equivalent enjoyed. This, of course, eventually led to him and his government being labeled as communist, and, as what would be standard operating practice for the CIA, a plot was implemented that resulted in the toppling of the elected government and the restoration of the autocratic Shah. I should note that it took two attempts at the coup. After the first, the Shah fled the country only to return after the US made Iran safe for him. The US supported the Shah and overlooked his illiberal or authoritarian tendencies because of, well, the Cold War. Iran was a reliable stalwart for the US against the Soviet-friendly regimes that arose in Egypt, Syria, and elsewhere. This is important, and perhaps the most important incident, that dictates the current relationship between the US and Iran. It was this event and the increasing need of the Shah to use repressive methods to maintain control over the country that led to his eventual overthrow in 1979. when the U.S. offered to depose Shah a sanctuary, this provided the religious radicals the excuse they needed to seize the American embassy, which not only embarrassed the U.S., but allowed the Ayatollah to take over what was then a broad coalition revolution. After this move, the Islamic Republic of Iran was born. It is important to note that Iran is the only Shiite-majority nation in the Middle East. The other regions are Sunni-dominated. This has added a sectarian flavor to much of the regional politics and conflict in the region. This is one of the reasons why that Iran supports Syria, where the ruling class are Shiites, their support of Hamas and Hezbollah, and the newly popularized Houthi in Yemen. In fact, Yemen is a great example of the two major Middle East powers, Saudi Arabia and Iran, vying for regional dominance. This was the same battle that went on between Saddam's Iraq and Iran. Right now, you have the Saudi planes bombing in support of the pro-Sunni government, while the Iranians are providing support for the Shiite insurgents, who have more or less taken over the country prior to the Saudi intervention. It's the Cold War all over, but with oil. Now that we have an idea of the past and its effect on the present, let's take a look at why Iran might want to have the bomb. Israel. And no, it is not because they want to wipe Israel off the map. Well, not in a serious way. No, ever since the 70s, Israel has been left alone by its Arab neighbors. And part of this is the many failed attempts to take on Israel. But it seems the real elephant in the room is that Israel developed the nuclear bomb in 1966 and has had a sizable stockpile by the end of the 1970s. Netanyahu is often heard to be railing about how crazy the Muslim leaders are and their apparent willingness to use the nuclear bomb. Well, it seems that Israel's Arab neighbors feel the same about their Jewish counterpart. It is a truism of international politics that once a nation has the bomb, it becomes untouchable by any of its neighbors, for fear that in retaliation for an attack, the bomb may be used on them. Thus, Israel has acted with impunity in the region, including military interventions in Lebanon, Gaza, and other places, bombing raids on Iraq, Syria, and others. Irrespective of whether Iran is or is not working on or wanting the bomb, every political strategist assumes it wants it to be just safe from Israel, to enjoy the same imperviousness Israel enjoys. It is also ironic that one reason we know as much as we do about the development of the nuclear energy in Iran is because it is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This allows the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, to investigate and monitor Iran's nuclear industry. And to be fair, it's found Iran to be lacking on more than one occasion. It was these violations, or failure to be completely open, some of which may be for nefarious reasons, but much of it can be blamed on Bush 2's axis of evil speech, which might have led Iranian leaders to fear an invasion, much like the one that occurred next door in Iraq. Irrespective of the realities of the, quote, threat Iran's nuclear ambitions present, the world united to impose harsh sanctions on Iran. It is these sanctions that has brought Iran to the negotiating table. On a side note, one of the reasons why Harper et al. Have been so ardent in their support of sanctions is because Iran may be trying to develop a nuclear bomb, that it has also not complied with the IAEA demands, and that the world feels it has little insight into the true state of Iran's nuclear project. And yet, it was just recently announced that Canada has signed a large deal with India to supply them with 3,000 tons of Saskatchewan uranium over the next 5 years. The best uranium in the world, I'm sure. Canada proud, or something. Anyway, Harper is 19-gun salute proud of this move, and yet, India is not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has, on a voluntary level, allowed the IAEA to inspect some, but not all, of its civilian nuclear facilities and none of its military sites, thus helping to fuel, literally and figuratively, the nuclear arms race that is currently taking place between India, Pakistan, and China, all of whom have been at war many times in the past and are currently building up stockpiles for a possible, but hopefully not inevitable, nuclear conflict. And then, of course, there's the whole fact that Israel, the only nuclear power in the Middle East, also hasn't signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, you may have also heard that the U.S. Congress is hell-bent on derailing these talks. Mostly, I think it's part of their anti-Obamaism, partly the irrational support of Israel, and of course, there's the military-industrial complex, which would profit from a war, the profit derived simply from the prospects of a war. So even if Obama signs an agreement with Iran, the U.S. may not actually implement it, And if this was a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Iran, well, that would be a big deal. However, as I mentioned earlier, the sanctions on Iran are global in nature. So negotiations are not only between Iran and the U.S., but also include the U.K., France, Germany, Russia, and China. So even if Obama fails to lift the sanctions, the other nations will follow through, which will both satisfy the Iranians as well as show what a laughingstock the U.S. has become on the global stage. Why would I say that the Iranians would be okay if the U.S. part of the agreement falls through? Well, I cannot believe that they are so completely ignorant to the state of U.S. politics, especially after the unprecedented open letter 47 U.S. senators sent to Iran stating that, even before knowing what the deal would be, they would tear it to shreds. So I'm quite sure that the Iranians are well aware that the U.S. may be the weak link, and are still willing to continue with negotiations anyway. And of course, many have said that you cannot trust the Iranians, that they will use this breathing room this agreement will create to accelerate the development of the bomb. And this may be true. This is also why the most important component of this deal, the part that has caused delays in its conclusion, is to find a balance in an open inspection regime, while keeping in mind that the U.S., if no one else, has used the IAEA and other UN agencies as front for their espionage. And don't even start it at what lengths the Israelis may go to destroy what is built up to be its existential threat. So ultimately, the line that Reagan used to justify the arms reduction treaty with the Soviet Union may seem very appropriate. Trust but verify. And therein lies the proof of this nuclear pudding. Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back after this.
SpongeBob! You're wasting me precious carbon dioxide! I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy! Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool!
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable! Big business does it again!
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Hello and we're back. With talk about nuclear war, one must also worry about the future. And in particular, humanity's second most favorite pastime, eating. With the global population expected to top over 11 billion by century's end, what will we be eating? Here's a top 10 foods of the future from the Web Wisdom series. Take it with a grain of salt and maybe a teaspoon of sugar. Enjoy!
We're looking at the top 10 foods of the future. In a number 10, it's vegetarian meat. The idea of meat consisting of ingredients that don't include animals would have seemed pretty far-fetched not so many years ago. Today we know differently, and the trend in this area will continue to grow as population growth begins to outpace currently available food sources. Meat production is a huge and expensive industry. Vegetarian products, however, are cheaper to produce and tend to be healthier as well. Great news for animal lovers. Most of us already know about soya products. Made from soya beans, these products have found some traction in Asia. Prepared properly, these products have a texture that is very similar to meat and with some inventive seasoning can provide a wide variety of flavor. Soya is just one example that is currently being used. Other innovative products show equal promise and look to be available in increasing quantities in coming years. This includes such products as corn, a fungus. Yeah, I know, but hey, so are mushrooms, and all kinds of stuff can be produced from that particular family of fungi. Anyway, corn is produced from a fermented fungus and reportedly tastes very similar to actual meat products. Add in such products produced from the likes of lupins to wheat gluten, and a very profitable and practical source of food is available from non-traditional sources, assuming that the products in question and other similar offerings can reproduce the taste and flavour of the meat products they hope to supplement or replace, then we may all be wolfing down a tree leaf burger in the very near future. Number 9. Cultured or in vitro meat. It's a true fact that a good deal of the world's population is carnivorous. We like our meat. And while there are other products that attempt to reproduce the taste, flavor, and texture of meat, some successful, others not so much, the truth of the matter is that these products are still not real meat. Sometimes we want a burger, a real, honest-to-God sandwich that began as a cow. Fortunately, science is working on resolving this primitive desire in a manner that may alleviate the need for an actual animal. In vitro or cultured meat involves growing meat. Growing is the best way to describe the process of tissue engineering that is required to accomplish this feat. The method entails taking cells from a live animal, which are used to then grow, well, meat. I don't pretend to understand the science behind all of this, but the idea is an interesting one. In fact, such a method could darn near resolve hunger around the world, theoretically. This idea is still in the development and research stage, but the potentials of a breakthrough are not difficult to imagine. Ready-made meat products that are easily manufactured without having to deal with herds of live animals would be incredibly profitable. And for the consumer, we will have our meat. Number 8. Algae. The first thing that comes to mind is, isn't this like eating fungus? No, not really. One of the interesting things about this particular subject matter is to reflect on the various changes that have come about concerning food production and consumption. Just 50 years ago, the answer to the world's growing consumption needs was the so-called Green Revolution. Farmers were introduced to scientifically altered hybrid seeds and new types of fertilizers to enhance crops. As a result, farmers were able to grow twice as much as before. The downside was the need for more land and water. We use a lot of water, but we are now close to a saturation point where traditional farming is prohibitive. As such, producers have begun to figure out how to grow food in places that normally are not very hospitable to do so. Enter algae. Algae are microscopic organisms that have the ability to grow very fast. More to the point, they can grow in the sea, and even in polluted water. Seaweed and kelp, in fact, are forms of algae. While most folks have not had a cuisine consisting of what could be considered sea grass, these forms of algae could provide an accessible and affordable dietary option. The real appeal of algae is in expanding the dietary offerings that it presents and in the byproducts such as algae oil that can be derived from this readily abundant source from nature. Hey, if blue whales and other marine life enjoy the stuff, maybe there's something to it after all. Number 7. Insects, bugs, and small critters. Truth is truth. We may not like it, but that doesn't impact on facts of the matter. And one truth that can be derived out of a discussion about the consumption of insects is that they provide a very good source of protein. And apparently we need protein. But that's not all. Of the various species of bugs that are eaten, well over 1,400 that are common, they all commonly provide a low-fat, low-cholesterol, and high-calcium and iron affair. Yes, they can be a bit slimy and crunchy, but they are good for you. While insects are not uncommon fodder in Asia, Africa, and South America, the rest of the world has not really followed suit. This probably has a lot to do with culture, perception, and need. Nevertheless, insects need very little space to breed, and it's generally inexpensive to do so as well. Add this to the fact that they can provide a nutritional meal, and we all have the makings of a new food group. Indeed, crickets, caterpillars, grasshoppers, and June beetles are just a few of the favored multi-legged delicacies available. In fact, there are a number of advocacy groups that are promoting the use of insects as a dietary staple. They have a legitimate point, especially when one considers the shortage of food in many parts of the world. Insects can provide an affordable source of the vital nutrients that humans need to survive. Granted, images of fried grasshopper may not be dancing in your head right now, but very soon you may have a craving for chocolate-covered ants. Just wait. Number 6. Seafood. The basic problem with meat is that maintaining the necessary livestock is becoming more and more unsustainable. One study declared that livestock took up 30% of available land space on the planet, not to mention the greenhouse effect of their biological emissions. Additionally, well over 50% of grain production, a good chunk of available farmland, is devoted to feeding livestock. Basically, with the ever-increasing population, we simply cannot raise enough cows to feed all these folks. The sea, on the other hand, provides an excellent source of food that is much easier to cultivate and breed. And I'm not talking about a bunch of fishermen out at sea hauling in more loads of produce. Images of the show Deadliest Catch and the movie A Perfect Storm are coming to mind. Rather, we are talking about fish farms on land, places where different types of fish are specifically bred and raised to be turned into a fillet. It certainly makes economic and practical sense. Seafood, of just about any variety, takes an enormous amount of resources to catch, whether we are talking about shrimp or crabs. The ability to produce these products in a more domestic fashion would make them more available, and presumably cheaper for us, the consumer. And the wide variety of species that make the water their home gives producers a plethora of choices to market. The new open ranges will be filled with trout. Number 5. Smaller animals. We're not exactly talking about rats in this case. Rather, we're talking about placing a larger emphasis on animals that are not as problematic as cattle to raise as a food source. With this, there are a whole host of animals that can provide a dietary substitute for beef. Rabbits, squirrels, coons, goats, and the like are on this list. In fact, in many parts of the world, these animals are consumed on a regular basis. The benefit of such animals is that you can raise more of them, relative to cattle, for consumption. Or so say the experts. I haven't done the math, but a typical steer provides about 400 pounds of meat. This works out to about 1,600 servings at 4 ounces per serving. Meanwhile, an average rabbit is 5 pounds. This provides about half its weight in edible meat, so you would need 160 rabbits for a comparable amount of meat. Nevertheless, smaller critters, even in the necessary greater numbers, are comparatively inexpensive and generate less greenhouse gas effects. In short, raising a gaggle of rabbits is a lot more economical, practical, and environmentally sound than a herd of cows. And honestly, grilled rabbit tastes pretty good. Number 4. Weeds. Well, maybe not weeds in the traditional sense, but some experts suggest the dietary benefits of a weed-like vegetation called purslane. This particular strain of vegetation is a nutritionist's dream. It's loaded with stuff like vitamin A, omega-3, and beta-carotene. According to one source, the chewy petals of this weed, it really is a weed, it has the affectionate nickname of pigweed, is more nutritious than vegetables like carrots and spinach. This alone makes it worth its while. Reportedly, it also tastes good. Unfortunately, at present, farmers hate purslane because it chokes off other crops that are more profitable. But the great thing about weeds, the darn things tend to grow everywhere. Purslane has adapted itself to grow in dry environments as well as areas with plentiful water, making it a prime choice for a crop in arid climates. As the world moves to more hardy food substances, especially those that are hardy and nutritious, we can expect to see vegetation, such as purslane, on our dinner plates in greater quantities. Yum! Number 3. Genetically modified food. Genetic manipulation is seen as the way of the future. The technology in this regard is still in the infancy stage, but the promise of being able to manipulate current foods into hardier, tastier, and more nutritious stock is a prime motivator in this area. Essentially, we are talking about making existing food better. This includes shortening the growing times of crops, making them more resistant to insects and other issues that plague crops, increasing yields, enabling crops to grow in areas that are not normally suitable to do so, and more. In fact, researchers are even speculating on engineering foods to fight certain diseases, like cancer. Imagine eating a piece of watermelon that has been genetically modified to provide a protein that allows someone with diabetes to forego taking insulin. On a more immediate application, genetic manipulation will allow foods to taste even better, blend flavors, or even invent totally new tastes to commonly known foods. We may be quite away from Star Trek-style food replicators, but the science of creating new food is right at our fingertips. 2. Nanofoods. If you are smarter than me, and you probably are, then you more than likely understand the difference between nanofoods and the above-mentioned genetically modified food. Scientists swear that there is a distinct difference between the two. From what I can gather, nanofood is a somewhat less ambitious scientific process. While genetically modified foods involves altering the very genes of a food, changing the essence of the item in question, nanofood technology restructures the molecular and atomic structure of foods using nanotechnology to produce nanoparticles. A fine line for sure, but a difference nonetheless. These nanoparticles can alter a way that a food tastes, what nutrients are produced, or even extend the life of a particular food. Currently, this science is used in packaging by extending the shelf life. Preservatives can be released into the food, improving product safety, by alerting consumers to spoiled food, and even repairing torn packaging through some sort of self-sealing process. One interesting development that is in the works by Kraft Foods is interactive products. Essentially, the company is attempting to use nanotechnology to cater a food's taste to individual consumers. Now that's getting food how you want it. Ultimately, what scientists hope to achieve is to be able to take this technology to the next level and perform feats that are more in line with genetic modification, changing taste and providing increased nutritional benefits. Suffice to say, this stuff is definitely next-generation technology that approaches science fiction. Number 1. Something we haven't thought of yet. If you would have told folks 100 years ago that we would have genetically altered seeds that would double the yield of crops, they probably would have thought you were reading too many science fiction novels. Yet, fiction, as crazy as it may sound, is the harbinger of things to come. We were dreaming of reaching the moon long before we actually did it. In this same fashion, the unimaginable in regards to food will probably be tomorrow's reality. I mentioned earlier the food replicators on Star Trek. Well, do you remember those handheld flip communicators they used? Take a look at the cell phones, older models now, that perform the same function. As such, it's not too hard to imagine a machine that could actually produce any kind of food you desire right out of the molecules that are floating around in the air. Or maybe the nutrient-enhanced slime that folks ate in The Matrix. Far-fetched? Maybe, but our imaginations will be the breeding grounds for the next evolution in food. As our food supplies continue to shrink, we will be forced to find ever new ways to feed our growing population. Perhaps the answer lies in space. New foods that can only be grown in a vacuum or on a space station, or maybe we can find a way to make dirt tasty and nutritious. For certain, I've seen people make a delicacy out of lawn grass. Whatever the case, you can bet that our great-grandchildren will find it hard to believe that we were actually eating meat from animals and vegetables that were grown in real soil. Just wait and watch.
Ah, interesting. Well, in an age of factory farming and industrial agriculture, not sure if food will maintain its position on life's most enjoyable things, but time will tell. So we'll be right back after this break.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back! So it seems a natural link to shift focus from the future of food to the future of people, and in particular, a SciShow look at the science of overpopulation. Let's listen in.
So I assume you know that there's a lot of people on this planet. As of last week, Wednesday, I think, was when we turned over to seven. Nobody knows, but nobody knows exactly how many people there are. It's kind of hard to keep track. It's a big planet. But there are about 7 billion people on the Earth right now. And they keep getting born all the time. In fact, for every 2 people who die, about 4 are born. Every second, there are about 4 babies introducing themselves to this world, and there are less than 2 people saying goodbye to it. So, easy math here, our world's population is growing by about 2.5 people per second. And as a reminder of this, during this video, I'm going to have 2.5 ping pong balls being thrown at me every single second throughout the entire rest of the video. Who's hitting me in the face every single time? Okay, instead of the balls, we're just gonna do a clock because I get nosebleeds pretty easily and I don't want you to have to see that. 7 billion people, it's hard to actually get your mind around how many people that is. I mean, if you were gonna just like sit down and count to 7 billion, it would take you like 200 years or something. On the other hand, there is plenty of space for them. If you took 7 billion people and stood us shoulder to shoulder like we were at a Sting concert, those 7 billion people could fit in an area the size of Los Angeles. We can fit on the Earth. There's space for us all. So as long as there's space for us all, what's the big deal about having 7 billion people? Well, it turns out people have been thinking about this for a long time, since around 1800, when the world first clocked 1 billion people. I know what you're thinking, you're like, 1 billion, that's nothing, hoo-ah! Well, at that time, all the economies in the world were based on agriculture. How much stuff we could grow with human hands, farm animals, maybe a scythe and a wooden plow or something. So that kind of technology, a billion people was really pushing it. And the first, like, big-time thinker guy to totally have a cow about there just being too many frickin' people was a British economist named Thomas Malthus. Thomas Malthus calculated that human populations tend to grow exponentially, while the ability of humans to feed each other tends to grow more linearly. And so our growth as a species, tends to outstrip our ability to feed everyone. And when that happens, it's pretty obvious what happens. You get the famine and the starvation, and for the people who are left over who don't die of those things, they can get taken care of by disease and war. Basically, Malthus thought that humanity's natural state was to be cruel, miserable, pathetic, and sniveling in a pile of dirty underpants. In his essay on the principle of population, Malthus observed, "The vices of mankind are active and able ministers of depopulation. They are the precursors in the great army of destruction, and often finish the dreadful work themselves. But should they fail in this war of extermination, sickly seasons, epidemics, pestilence, and plague advance in terrific array and sweep off their thousands and tens of thousands. Should their success be still incomplete, gigantic, inevitable famine stalks in the rear and with one mighty blow levels the population with the food of the world." Diseases also have an easier time taking hold, and of course, starvation can kill off a lot of people as well. Though we did make some pretty good points. As long as humanity is well fed, we're pretty nice lot of people. But I have this problem too. When my blood sugar just gets a little bit low, I start killing all of my neighbor. That's not actually true. When you and your family's lives are threatened by starvation, there's a lot of things that you will do for food, including go to war. However, what Mr. Doom and Gloom didn't predict was the frickin' Industrial Revolution, which not only allowed the production of much more food with far fewer laborers, it was also the impetus for this. What that there is the population of the Earth busting through Malthus's ceiling, and then his atmosphere, and then his ozone layer, and then his mesosphere, and then his... Probably be pretty impressed by this. If you're not impressed yet, just keep staring at it. I can wait. I got all day. It took humanity 50,000 years to go from 0 to 1 billion people, and then to get from 1 billion to 7 billion, about 200. So wow, Industrial Revolution, thank you for allowing us to grow more food using machines and for the fast and efficient transportation that it takes to move all that food around to the people who needed it. And thanks for the medical advances too, which help us understand things like the importance of soap and the way that diseases worked. And as a result, humans now live about 4 decades longer than the average guy in the 18th century. Yeah, Industrial Revolution. So Malthus might have been right about how frickin' stupid it was to be a human if the Industrial Revolution had not happened. So now, the world's population is growing at about 1.1% per year, which is a tiny bit better than the 1.3% per year that got us here. If this current rate continues by 2050, we should have about 9.3 billion people on the planet. So the question is, at what point are these numbers going to outstrip our ability to feed all of the people on the planet? It turns out, actually, that the question isn't how many people can the Earth accommodate. It's more like, how many rich people can the Earth accommodate? Because people in general, they tend to demand stuff for their survival, like oxygen, water, and food. But rich people, we have different expectations. We, for example, in America have a lot of agricultural crops, and we have to use a lot of fresh water to water those agricultural crops. Do you want to take a guess at the number one irrigated crop in the United States of America? Unless you've heard this statistic before, you were wrong. It's grass. It takes more water to create lawns than it does to create all of the corn in America. We're using it like crazy. Though it is a pretty scarce resource, we can use less than 1% of the water on our planet. Most of it is salt water that we cannot use to drink or irrigate crops. And 70% of our fresh water is frozen in glaciers. So clean fresh water, non-negotiable and scarce. So what's next? Food. The world's combined food output could feed around 11 billion people, and yet there are 1 billion people who need food. So yeah, that's one of the most pathetic and infuriating things about our planet. So if there's enough food for 11 billion people, and there's 7 billion people, and a billion of them are hungry, who is eating all of our food? Food is eating all that food. A huge amount of the food that we grow in America gets in turn eaten by livestock. It's so hard to say the truth, which is that, but rich people can do what they want. Now, when I say rich, it's important to note that I'm not talking about, like, the 99% versus the 1% rich. I'm talking about if you have running water, electricity that comes into your home, a computer that you can watch YouTube videos on, and regularly can afford to eat meat, you're a rich person. On the Earth. And you know, sometimes we just have to come to terms with the fact that we, even those of us who don't have it great in America, have it better off than a whole lot of other people. There's a lot of people in the world who don't get that. If you can have a hot shower, that's like the peak of luxury to me. So assuming that you are a first worlder, that you live in a developed country in Europe, or you live in America or Japan, you consume, on average, as much stuff
as 32 Kenyans.
And now the number of well-off people in the world is starting to increase dramatically and quickly. And this is what we've always wanted for the world. So now we have all these moderately well-off people walking around all over the planet, and it's great, except that they require more. In the meantime, though, a huge percentage of all of the babies that we're talking about being born right now aren't being born to these rich people in the developed world. They're being born in developing nations, and so the population isn't just growing. It's growing in this weird, sort of scary, lopsided way. In fact, as people in a lot of developed countries have kind of stopped having babies, like Japan, for example. Everybody's like, Japan, what are you doing? Why aren't you having any babies? And Japan's like, I don't know. I don't feel like it. So on average, Japanese are having about one baby per household. They're not even replacing themselves, compared to two or three babies in America, or like five or six in most of sub-Saharan Africa. So developing nations are having a baby boom, and that's what happens when you get, you know, vaccines and antibiotics and safe water and better sanitation. You get fewer babies dying, and we are all completely and totally in favor of fewer babies dying, I hope. But it also means that there are going to be a lot of new sub-Saharan Africans in the next 50 years or so, and that is where a lot of the 1 billion currently hungry people are already living. So while those of us in the developed world are not having any babies at all, and yet consuming enough food for like 4 truckloads of babies, the governments of developing countries are struggling with where to put all of these new people and how to feed them all. And you also get what is known as a youth bulge. A lot of developing nations are currently seeing a huge explosion in people between the ages of 15 and like 29. And all those youth are out there looking for the same jobs, all at the same time, feeling generally hormonal, as youth do, and being pretty unhappy with their lot in life. Some social scientists conjecture that youth bulges like this have been responsible for nearly every insurrection in history, from the English Revolution in 1640 to the more recent Arab Spring. And neither of those things were bad things, but we should be aware that there may be more of it coming. And another thing that Reverend Malthus never thought of is what happens when humanity gets together and takes over the whole freaking world. Seriously, because it turns out that there are actually supposed to be some other things living on this planet with us. Through our desire for more space and more stuff, we're putting pressure on pretty much every habitat on Earth. So much so that worldwide, 52 species of mammal, amphibian, and bird move one category closer to extinction every single year. You know, this world is pretty big, but there's only so much room, and it turns out the Bengal tigers aren't particularly well suited to high-rise living. So the more there are of us, the fewer of literally everything else there is, except for, like, things that we enjoy eating and petting, dogs and cats as well. Their populations continue to grow. So happy birthday, new people. Welcome to Earth. I'll try not to screw it up too much for you.
That was cool. Now, before we're credited out, let's take a claim on our name. What is in a name? And the often overlooked, but underappreciated, peak name. What is peak name? Well, it's a point in the future where there will be no more new names. So let's listen in to Vsauce's take on this particular problem of peak name.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, right now, in America, there are 106 people named Harry Potter, 1,007 named James Bond, and 8 people named Justin Bieber. They're just aren't enough names to go around. There are more than 300 million people in America, but 150,000 last names and 5,000 first names is all you need to name 9 out of every 10 of them. When are we going to run out of names? Perhaps it's already happened to you. If it hasn't, when? 10 years, 20 years, 100, 1,000? When will someone with your exact name become famous? So famous, in fact, that your legacy changes forever to just being not the person people think of when they hear your name. And for that matter, when will every reasonably memorable, pronounceable band name or brand name be taken? When will authors have no choice but to just start reusing book titles? According to Rovi Corp, owner of AllMusic.com, the most used band name is Bliss, followed in order by Mirage, One, Gemini, Legacy, Paradox, and Rain. In the past, when fewer bands had already been created and you couldn't just Google up every single band, overlap was easier to get away with, and one-word band names were plentiful. But now, after years and years and years of band formation, well, we have the who, but we also have the what, the where, the when, the why, the how, and even the. In order to stand out now and have your own unique name, you have to be a bit more creative. Oh, Diarrhea Planet. Or Betty's Not a Vitamin. Which, by the way, is no longer true. Betty became a vitamin in 1994. What about Twitter handles or email addresses? Have we already reached peak username? We already find ourselves often having to use abbreviations, initials, numbers, or just choosing something completely different. Will our children, or our children's children, live in a world where the only remaining Gmail addresses are just random strings of alphanumeric characters? Are we approaching a name crisis? And if so, should we even call it a name crisis, lest we use up yet another precious name? Maybe you already share your name with someone famous, but if you don't, how long will it be until you probably will? I mean, new famous people are popping up all the time, faster now than ever before because of the internet, and they are gobbling up top Google search billing. Maybe it won't happen until long after you've been dead, but shouldn't the reservoir of names not taken by notable people eventually run out? Computer scientist Samuel Arbesman approximated how many famous people there are alive today, and I think his calculation will be helpful. You see, he points out that if we allow famous to simply mean being notable enough to have your own Wikipedia page, well, because there are 700,000 living people with Wikipedia pages right now, that means one out of every 10,000 people on Earth today are famous. Assuming at the least that that proportion remains constant, since 255 people are born every minute, that means every hour a future famous person is born. Their name destined to become primarily associated with them. Not everyone else who shares their name. All of those people will be relegated to disambiguation or the postnomial, not the famous one. Luckily, if you do the math, you'll find that even at a rate of one future famous person born every hour, it would still take dozens of millennia for most of us to expect a future famous person with our exact name to emerge. Plus, names change. New ones become popular, others obsolesce. But for fun, let's not focus on names we popularly use and instead look at how many possible names there can be. The Social Security Administration allows up to 36 letters for a complete name. Now, including spaces, 27 letters filling 36 spots with repetition allowed means 3 sextillion possible combinations. That's more than Earth has atoms. So let's refine our limits. How many pronounceable names are possible? For that, I say we look at what Randall Munroe, the author of the fantastic What If, did when asked about naming stars. If you want to give every single star in the observable universe a unique but pronounceable English name, how long would the names have to be? His approximation is really fascinating. If we define a pronounceable word as a word that contains consonant-vowel pairs, we can roughly figure that there are about 105 different such pair possibilities. 105. That's not too much different from 99. So funny enough, there are about the same number of consonant-vowel pairs possible as there are two-digit numbers, which means we could give every star in the observable universe a sayable, unique name with just 24 letters, the same number of digits it would take to just number all of them. So the bottom line is we may each have to give up uniquely owning a word or name that's common today, but the potential number of names that can be made is really hardy. In fact, before we run out of those, our species will likely evolve to communicate in a completely different way. Also, names aren't just labels. A name on a screen, a username, a handle, a screen name, doesn't always act exactly like its owner. Usernames can travel more quickly and more widely than flesh and blood people and do things that their puppeteers wouldn't normally do away from the keyboard. It's called the online disinhibition effect. If you can't see the people you're interacting with and they can't see you, you're all just online hiding behind different names than usual, why hold back? I mean, clearly such a system can't be serious business. On the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Why be nice or tell the truth? The subreddit Karma Court investigates and uncovers people who may think that the less face-to-face nature of the internet makes lies easier to get away with. Like this person who posted an image suggesting that they'd been single for a year, but had, users found out, posted 3 months earlier a picture of my girlfriend's cat. These behaviors aren't just what humans do when they can be anonymous or can hide behind different names. These behaviors can also be caused by the names themselves. Studies have found that the username you use can impact how you behave. Your own pre-existing stereotypes and expectations of certain words, shapes, colors can be confirmed by your behavior, in the same way that studies have found NFL and NHL players play more aggressively when wearing black uniforms. Studies have also found that the more sexualized an avatar is you make someone use, the more conscious they will be of their own body image. And the more an avatar resembles you, the more correlated you watching it exercise is with you being more likely to exercise more. It's called the Proteus effect. The features of a cyberspace version of yourself, a username, an avatar, can actually change you, the meat space IRL you. Usernames and avatars, then, aren't just handles attached to us. Psychologically, we often interact with them as if they're friends, distinct beings we created. They help us out, but they also can influence us, egg us on, dare us to do things we wouldn't normally do because they offer us protection, entertainment. Some make us feel safe, professional, funny, dangerous, attractive. We want cool ones. The cool ones make us look cool. As we go about our daily lives and vie for attention, we are more and more frequently doing so with another name, and exclusively through that name only. So it becomes quite interesting that we're not going to run out of them anytime soon. In fact, they might run out of us first, and may, in many ways, run us.
And so this is all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite.
You think we're savages because we don't live in stone castles. We can't make steel as good as yours, it's true, but we're free.
I'm a free woman.
You're not a free woman.
You're my prisoner, prisoner.
You don't need to live your whole life taking commands from old men. Be free. I'm a free woman.
You're not a free woman. You're my prisoner, prisoner.
You know nothing. Wake up when you want to wake up. Be free. Build yourself a cabin. Find a woman to lie with in the night. You don't need to live your whole life taking commands from old men. Be free. I'm a free woman.
You're not a free woman. You're my prisoner, prisoner.
You know nothing, nothing. Wake up when you want to wake up. Be free.
Seven kingdoms are at war, and Winterfell is mine. Every man, woman, and child will know who we were and how long we stood.
We die today, brothers. We die
from our 100 moons.
From our 100 moons.
Our war cries.
It will last for years.
Don't be afraid. The Queen has raised the drawbridge. This is the safest place we can be. Shall we sing a hymn?
Save our sons from war, we pray. Save our sons from war, we pray. Gentle Mother, font of mercy. Save our sons from war, we pray. Save our sons from war, we pray.
Hey CITR listeners, thank you again for your continuing support. Because of your generous donations and assistance, CITR rose over $42,000 for our annual fund.